I would like to quote from Dr. Thomas Cowan, the other co-author of The Truth About Contagion. What could possibly be wrong with having an open and honest debate about the nature and cause of illness and disease? Today we won't be debating, but listening to the other co-author, Sally Fallon, presenting important information for those of us interested in learning about our health. You may know her as the author of Nourishing Tradition and as the founding president of the Weston A. Price Foundation. I'm Robin. Stay tuned for Tributaries. Sally, the information in the book you've written with Dr. Thomas Cowan, The Truth About Contagion, Exploring Theories of How Disease Spreads, did not start with COVID for you. Your life's work about healthcare has rightfully been questioning the status quo about how to live a healthy life. So let me start by thanking you for that.
Well, I guess I'm not shy about going after widely held ideas. I mean, we have insisted that animal fats are essential to life, that raw milk is safe and healthy. So why not look at this whole business of contagion? And basically, while our book focuses on COVID, we actually go back in time and look at this whole notion of contagious disease and conclude that it is false. There is no such thing as contagious disease. A disease is called by nutrient deficiencies, poisons, and injuries, including, I would say, birth injuries or what they call genetic diseases and stuff, although we could go there too. But anyway, I think it's becoming clear that this whole COVID nonsense is just going to keep going. They have the whole Greek alphabet to go through for variants up to Omega. We're only on Delta now, right? And to explain why none of these measures that they're doing are working. Masks don't work, vaccinations don't work, social distancing doesn't work. The only way they can explain that is to pull another variant out of the hat.
Well, let's start with where you get started in your book.
Okay.
By following the science. I mean, that has become a mantra to so many. And yet, what science are we following? So what do you suggest? Do we go to Pasteur's Final Words or Rivers and Koch's Scientific Postulates? And
What got me started was reading The Invisible Rainbow by Arthur Furstenberg. And it was like this aha moment. They were talking about the Spanish flu, which was the 1918 version of COVID, I guess, and it killed 50 million people worldwide. And the New York Public Health Service did contagion studies on this. And they took sick people and exposed them to well people in various ways, such as having the sick people spit on the well people, breathe on the well people. They took secretions from the sick people and put them down the nostrils of the well people. They took blood from the sick people and injected it into the well people, and they could not make the well people get sick from any type of exposure to the people who had Spanish flu. So it was not a contagious disease, and this was written up in several peer-reviewed journals, totally forgotten and ignored. So the question is, what was causing this? And the explanation, what I consider a very good explanation, is the rollout of radio towers worldwide, and this did happen worldwide in a very short amount of time, starting with military bases. Now, there were certain things that made the disease worse. For example, the fact that the military people had been so heavily vaccinated, and also that they treated it with the worst thing they could have treated it with, which was aspirin, which caused blood thinning in a situation where they were already getting blood problems. And the homeopathic hospitals had a very low death rate from the flu. So it was two things. It was the exposure to the toxin and then the way they treated it, which was completely wrong. I think there are a lot of parallels with today, don't you?
Yes, yes, absolutely. And we may as well move, since you've started there, into resonance. All of nature lives in resonance. And it's relating, obviously, by just what you said now. And the correlation today is, of course, the 5G.
Right. The outbreak of COVID across the world strongly correlates with the deployment of 5G, which started in Wuhan, China, where they turned on 10,000 base stations at once. People were just dropping in the streets. And then it moved to Europe, where they brought out in Spain and Italy, and then moving north. And by the way, the country with the most COVID cases per person is San Marino, and they've had 5G the longest and the most heavily deployed there. COVID came to New York, where they deployed 5G, then the larger cities, and now we're seeing outbreaks in smaller cities and other countries where they're bringing out 5G. So a perfect example is Jacksonville, Florida, where a lot of people are suddenly getting sick. And Robin, we just are not going to solve this until we realize what the cause is. A perfect example is pellagra, which was considered to be contagious and caused by a virus or a germ. And the researcher who was researching niacin, pellagra is a niacin deficiency, he said because there was such a strong belief in the contagiousness of this disease, it took way longer than it should have for us to solve the problem. Scurvy is similar. Scurvy was considered contagious, broke out on ships, and they thought one sailor gave it to another. And they couldn't solve the disease until they figured out that it was actually a vitamin C deficiency. And I think you can say the same thing today. We're not going to solve this worldwide problem until we realize what the cause is.
I can just hear reverberating in the universe right now, people going, well, what about chicken pox and all of those children's diseases or measles?
Right.
Can you explain, just take one of those maybe and give another explanation?
First, let me go back to this whole notion of resonance, which you brought up, because I think it's apropos here.
Sure.
So what we know now is that our DNA are antenna and they are receivers and transmitters. Our cells communicate with each other through DNA and we can communicate with other people through our DNA. You know, they say fear is contagious. Well, it's contagious in part because of this kind of resonance between people. And I think the childhood diseases, I'm sure that there is an element of toxins or poor nutrition, but the question is, why do people get it when you have measles parties? And I think that's where this whole notion of resonance comes in. Measles is a disease for children about 7 years old. It's a kind of detoxification before they go into the next phase of their life, and you have a measles party, and the sick child is saying, hey, everybody, it's time. It's time for us to get the measles. And that is communicated.
Yes, you know, it's really interesting. My son-in-law was really quite astute in raising their daughter. Every time she had some kind of a bad cold or something, he noticed she was changed on a lot of different levels.
Tom Cowan gives a wonderful example of his son had the measles. And the son had been doing some kind of drawing, and then he got the measles. He just left the drawing on the desk. And after he got the measles, he came down and finished the drawing, but on a whole new level. It was much more sophisticated and mature. It's important for children to have measles. It's like a springboard into the next phase of your life.
Maybe talk a little bit about how the scientific postulate of Koch has not been really working. There is a failure to satisfy his original postulates, which would create the scientific theory for truth, I guess, or for...
Right. So this is Robert Koch, the German scientist. So the germ theory, which is that there is a specific microbe causing every single specific disease, was formulated by two people. One is Louis Pasteur in France and Robert Koch in Germany, and they worked at the same time, and they were kind of rivals. And it needs to be stated that neither of them actually proved this theorem. So the theorem was, if you had a sick person, let's say a person with TB, to prove Koch's postulates that it was caused by a bacillus, you had to take the snot or whatever from that person and from that isolate the bacillus and then inject that into a well person, and they would get sick from just that injection, and then you could isolate the same bacillus from the sick person. And Koch was never able to do this in his lifetime. He worked with TB, and he could not make people sick by spraying secretions from people with TB into the lungs of well people. He just couldn't do that. He claimed that he had caused TB by injecting what he said was a bacillus, but it was a bacillus with a lot of poisons also into an animal, and around the injection they got these little tiny tumors or cysts or something. And he said that proved that he'd caused TB, but it wasn't TB. So, and he never was able to transfer TB in the way that we think is people get it, by breathing on others.
So further down the rabbit hole we go here.
Yeah, and the point is, over the years, over time, nobody says this anymore, that every disease is caused by a specific microbe. Nobody says that anymore. We know that there are other causes of disease, like malnutrition or toxins. And even things like TB, it's now admitted that 9 out of 10 people who quote-unquote test positive, whatever that means, are what they call latent, L-A-T-E-N-T, and they don't spread and they don't have it. So that kind of eliminates the theory, really.
Yes, and it's amazing how many correlations can be made for all of these theories, and then they shift into being causations, and we either don't get the full story, or there are so many causes that can be affecting something, we can't even right. begin to imagine all of them, or nearly some of them.
The thing is that the germ theory morphs into modern medicine. You can make money off the germ theory. You can't make money off of nutritional deficiencies.
Right.
So with the germ theory, we get antibiotics, we get toxic drugs, we get vaccinations, because they're all based on the germ theory. And if the germ theory is disproven, then that's a big monetary stream that goes away. You know, another really good example is leprosy. Leprosy used to be considered extremely contagious.
Yes.
And they had hospitals for lepers.
They had islands.
Yeah. Well, the one I know about was in Louisiana. And if you showed any signs of a nervous disorder or skin problems, they arrested you and put you in these hospitals and you could never leave. And the one in Louisiana was run by nuns, and none of the nuns ever got sick from exposure to the lepers, so-called lepers. And they called that a miracle. But anyway, today leprosy is considered not very contagious. And in fact, if you look at the symptoms of scleroderma, they are identical to the symptoms of leprosy, and that's considered an autoimmune disease. So, you know, little by little, all of these diseases that were considered highly contagious are revealing themselves to be something else.
Now, would you share some of what's in the book regarding just really basic facts about what is the bacteria doing in the body? How does it work? And why might there be an abnormal proliferation? Bioremediation is a good thing. And then the same thing goes for viruses. And then exosomes are actually a lot lesser known than bacteria and virus.
And viruses. Well, let's start with bacteria, because we can really see bacteria with a regular microscope. And the bacteria, as you know, in the last 20 years, we've had a complete paradigm shift about bacteria. The old theory was that bacteria attack the body. The body's supposed to be sterile. And bacteria attack and make us sick. And that was the theory. Now we know that we live in symbiotic relationship with bacteria. We're supposed to have about 6 pounds of bacteria in the gut. And without that bacteria, we couldn't live. It's 85% of our immune system. The bacteria make vitamins. They make feel-good chemicals. So we have a whole different view of bacteria today. We know that under certain circumstances, like lack of oxygen, such as in a root canal or in certain situations, the bacteria will morph into strains that produce certain toxins. But that's the environment. It's not the bacteria. Solution is not to kill the bacteria. The solution is to change the environment. Now, viruses are different. You can't see viruses with a regular microscope, and they were only, quote-unquote, discovered in 1931 when they came up with the electron microscope, and they saw these tiny little round things inside the cell. Now, it must be said that to make a culture for the electron microscope, you have to squish the cell and poison it, and so it's not quite clear, you know, what these little round things are, but scientists hailed this as the discovery of these long-sought viruses that they had been assuming were causing disease. Virus just means poison, because a lot of times they couldn't find a bacteria that was causing a disease. So they said, well, it's some virus. Well, when they discovered the electron microscope, they said that these little round things were viruses. But the problem was that they were very hard to isolate, separate out, so that you only had viruses. So you could do Koch's postulates. In fact, it was impossible to separate them out. I was just talking to Mike Adams the other day, and he was saying he tried to order isolated virus for his lab, and it turned out there is no such thing as isolated virus. They don't have isolated virus. And a lot of scientists are saying, you know, we don't think these are bad. We think these are good. And they're called exosomes. They shouldn't be called viruses. And what they do when the cell is breaking down or when it's poisoned, they encapsulate the poisons and take them out of the cell. And they also contain this genetic material that, through resonance, communicates with other cells and tells them, hey, something's coming, be careful. And one of the things we postulate in the book is that it was actually through the actions of exosomes that our bodies become accustomed to things like radio waves or even 5G. We can adapt. It's the exosomes that help us adapt. They're not bad. They're actually good.
Right. They're heralding the change. And some people will survive and some people won't. I think that's been all throughout history, obviously. When big changes like the 5G that's just arrived, it's not going to kill off the entire planet, but everybody doesn't adjust.
Not everyone is capable of adjusting. And then we come back to nutrition. And we also, I think, come back to how to protect yourselves. I give the example of the Industrial Revolution, which made a lot of people move into the cities. And the cities were just cesspools. The Industrial Revolution happened before the car came along. So the only transportation was horses and mules. So the cities were just full of stinking heaps of manure everywhere. There were no real sewage systems. There was no clean water. People got sick from all these poisons in the sewage and so forth. And it took 200 years to clean up after the Industrial Revolution happened, to put in sewers, to get clean water. You know, it was only in 1890 that the water system in Chicago stopped taking water from the part of the lake where they were dumping the sewage. It took a long time. And in the meantime, we got automobiles. And, of course, they have their own problems, but at least you weren't living with manure all the time. It was like a 200-year cleanup period. Now we've rolled out this brand-new technology called 5G, and people want it. They want fast computers. But it's the same thing. We've just gone pell-mell into this new technology with no thought of the dangers, and now we're going to have to clean up. We're going to have to figure out how to make this safe. And a lot of people are doing that in their houses. You know, in our house, we have no Wi-Fi in our house. We have it all in wires. These are, unfortunately, not cheap things to do. They're expensive to do, but eventually we will clean up our houses from Wi-Fi, just like we put bathrooms in our houses instead of going out to the outhouse. Eventually made things cleaner, and we're going to have to make things safer with the microwave technology. Yeah, and I do think we adjust to a certain extent. I don't know if we can completely adjust. I think we need to exercise certain precautions. For example, I wouldn't have your cell phone by your head at night when you sleep. I don't think that's a good idea. Okay. I think it's good to keep your landline and minimize your use of a cell phone. I'm not saying to give them away, because we need them now. I think computers are wonderful, but I've got my computer set up so I can put an EMF meter right up to it and it's green. So there's a lot of things that we can learn. In fact, I've written a series of blogs on this called Building Biology, which is on my blog.
Which is where can people find it?
It's nourishingtraditions.com. In fact, I've written a bunch of blogs on COVID, and that's kind of how the book started. I wrote a blog, Is Coronavirus Contagious? And Tom Cowan did a talk. It's like a 10-minute talk that went viral about the 5G technology. And we decided to put that together as a book. So it happened very fast. We wrote that book in 2 months, Robin.
Oh, that's amazing.
It all fits. And as I say, everybody is dismayed that we're having all these new outbreaks, even after so many people got shots and wore masks and everything. We're not going to solve this until we realize what the cause is.
Right. Well, as you write in your book, it's smarter but less profitable to clean up cities, improve diets, mitigate poverty, and reduce pollution.
And there's no quick profit in the cleanup part. Eventually, you have to do it. And we did it for the cities and for the, you know, Industrial Revolution. We completely formulated gasoline so that we wouldn't have pollution from gasoline. But that took 100 years. Now we need to clean up the mess that we've made from a wireless communication.
Are you privy to any kind of EMF protection that could actually broadcast in a city?
I'm not, but I think something like that has to come along. Now, the ideal thing is that inside your buildings, you don't have Wi-Fi. And in fact, that's one good thing about 5G. It doesn't come into buildings. Yet. they're working on that. So you can have a 5G-free house. Even if your city doesn't have Fios, which is in the wires, you can still put it in your house. The Wi-Fi comes to your house, but you can take it from there and put it in wires in your house. So there really are ways to mitigate it. Unfortunately, none of them are free. I mean, they require a certain investment.
Right. Now, Sally, what is the strongest argument that you and perhaps Tom maybe have come across in not wanting to take in the information that you have?
The most vociferous argument against us is that, oh, you're crazy. We know there's thousands of studies about isolated virus. And if you do a search for isolated virus on PubMed, I think you get almost 300,000 studies that talk about isolated virus. But when you start to look at these studies, what they're doing is they're buying these so-called cultures that are called isolated virus, and they're not isolated virus. What they do is they take some snot or secretion from a sick person, and they centrifuge it. They haven't isolated it in the first place, and then they're culturing it with all these poisons and stuff, and you get a lot of cellular breakdown. And that's what they're calling isolated virus. And it's no such thing. It's absolutely no such thing.
And we did touch upon the electron microscope, and that's why live cell or dark field microscopy is so much better for reading blood, because it's live and things get bent out of shape when you're looking at it, and actually they're dead when you look at them through the electron microscope.
Exactly. It's dead and it's disrupted. The cell walls are disrupted. You really don't know what you're looking at. You're looking at fragments of the cell, and you don't know how they all fit together in there with maybe a few little dots, but we don't know what those dots really are.
Right. I don't know if you're familiar with Gaston Naissons.
Yes.
He found in his microscope that he actually developed what he could see were these things he termed and called somatids. And he could see them move through progression, say, from 1 to 10. And if you were at 8, he would say, you know, you're bordering on cancer right now, basically, because this is how this works. He could tell how soon you would be getting cancer unless you change the actual environment.
Environment,
of course,
right.
There was
the somatids change depending on the environment.
Exactly.
One-celled animals are not like dogs and cats and humans. They actually can change form. They can start to secrete toxins. They can do all kinds of things depending on the environment.
Right. And just curiously, he was in one of the most famous trials in Canada because he was brought up about practicing medicine without a license and for murder because someone died that went to see him. And a head of a hospital said, well, your cure has no cancer-killing agents in it. And he said, well, you're right. It's like the pond and mosquitoes. You change the environment of the pond and the mosquitoes are just going to go away because it's not their type of environment.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
One of the things that never really considered as a source of toxins is insect bites. And there's some very strong toxins in insect bites. And one of the diseases I look at in the book is smallpox, which was considered highly contagious. And that was one of the first things they developed a vaccine for.
Yes.
But there was a doctor in Texas. He had a clinic, and he completely eliminated smallpox from his clinic by making sure the beds were clean, making sure there were no bed bugs, or having people sleep in hammocks. And his belief was that bed bugs caused smallpox because they had a toxin in their bite. And he completely eliminated smallpox by doing this, and we don't live with bugs the way people used to live with bugs. That's a really good example of a disease that's completely disappeared with cleanliness.
Now, Sally, I do have one last question for you. Thomas writes in his intro that you two are spiritual compadres as well.
Oh.
And does that conversation between the two of you ever move into how all of these connections for health and disease are simply appearances and the cause and effect conclusions still don't even have enough information and it becomes a spiritual thing?
Well, we certainly have talked about what we call epidemiological observations. And, you know, you can say it's all these people were in the same place, they all got sick. That's an epidemiological observation, but it doesn't prove contagion. A better explanation is that you were all exposed to the same toxin or same radio frequency or whatever. So we definitely have discussed that.
Okay.
I was surprised that he said that.
Well,
but I think it's kind of interesting. Tom was the first person who called me after Nourishing Traditions was published, and we have been collaborating ever since. It's really been a very nice, friendly relationship. We've never had a disagreement. It's been a very harmonious professional relationship.
Oh, that's great.
And by the way, I wanted to say our original title was The Contagion Myth.
Yeah.
You can still get it on Barnes & Noble under The Contagion Myth, and
okay.
Amazon banned it. They wouldn't take that title. Yes. We had coronavirus in the subtitle, but the publisher very wisely changed the title, and they did get it on Amazon, so it's in both places. And I do updates at nourishingtraditions.com.
Great. Thanks to Sally Fallon Morell for exploring theories in healthcare with us. For anything tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com, and podcasts are on the usual platforms. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.